ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration, and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition, those two.
With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
I think what occurred back in the 80s, particularly when we were looking at creatives, we were developing our own theatre companies. We were looking at, you know, Bimali, Bangdara, all these companies were forming that were Aboriginal-led. And so there was a shift in the control and the power of product, that the authorship and control was from a First Nations lens. And we went on to see some great developments. I think the film industry, that has been a great catalyst to look at the model they used. A very slow step of capacity building to the point where you get our producers, filmmakers, DOPs in the mainstream.
Remembering Artie Rhoda Roberts, a pioneer in the creative industries who inspired generations of First Nations storytellers, and a new peak body to tackle family, domestic and sexual violence against First Nations women.
Many of our people said, we don't know what the data is. We don't know what the incidence of family violence is. Is it our Aboriginal men that's perpetrating the violence? Is it non-Aboriginal men? Is it perpetrated against, you know, what age group? Where's the violence most likely? Is it in the schools? Is it with young boys? Is it young girls more accepting of violence? We just didn't have enough information.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. A trailblazer in the world of arts and media, Auntie Rhoda Roberts paved the way for generations of First Nations creatives across the country and the world. Her recent passing reminded us of her lasting legacy and indelible impact on the Indigenous community. A Wadjibal Wabal woman of the Bundjalung Nation, Auntie Rhoda was born a twin and grew up with her family on the New South Wales North Coast. Her father, Frank Roberts, was a pastor and an activist, while her mother, Muriel, had more of an artistic side to her, and it inspired Rhoda to dream big and pursue her passions. And that she definitely did. From a young age, she began acting and touring with Brian Siren's acting studio, where she saw there wasn't enough Indigenous representation in the arts. And in fact, I first met her through Uncle Brian Siren. These experiences inspired her and other actors to set up the Aboriginal National Theatre Trust. From there, she went on to be the first Aboriginal presenter of mainstream television, presenting SBS's First Line. She later became the first Indigenous presenter on a primetime current affairs program, Vox Populi. She was also a prominent voice on radio, hosting shows such as Deadly Sounds and our titter show, Away. When Auntie Rhoda stepped down from her position as head of Indigenous programming at the Sydney Opera House, I spoke with her about her life and career up to that point, just as she was getting ready to take on a role as SBS Elder in Residence. We'll talk about your final two projects shortly, but it's a perfect time to take a look back at your career so far. What first drew you to the media sector?
As in working at SBS and being the first Aboriginal to host a primetime current affairs program, which was pretty exciting back in the day. You know, one of the big things about that job was it made me realise the use of terminology and the power that it has. I remember once doing a piece to camera saying, for non-Indigenous Australians, and I received an enormous amount of letters with people disclaiming, how dare I call them non-Indigenous Australians. And I went, wow, there is power in the words you use.
When you reflect back, what were the barriers facing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander creatives at this time?
Look, I think there was a renaissance in the 70s and the early 80s, and we started to see a groundswell of work, which is not unfamiliar with the 90s and the 2000s. And then things always tend to go quiet for about a decade. And I don't know if that's because people are burnt out or that we just haven't been able to address systemic behaviours across the nation. But I think there is progress being made now. I think what occurred back in the 80s, particularly when we were looking at creatives, we were developing our own theatre companies. We were looking at, you know, Bimali, Bangdara, all these companies were forming that were Aboriginal-led. And so there was a shift in the control and the power of product, that the authorship and control was from a First Nations lens. And we went on to see some great developments. I think the film industry, that has been a great catalyst to look at the model they used. A very slow, slow step of capacity building to the point where you get our producers, filmmakers, DOPs in the mainstream. And I think it's just been such a fantastic model, which I've tried to apply to a lot of the work I've done. But, you know, it always takes the team, and it always takes those ones who went before us. You know, I think of the work of Brian Siren and Justine Saunders and many of the playwrights of the time, particularly Ujuru Noonuccal, and how generous they were with their knowledge, but also how open and flexible they were to passing on the mantle.
One thing that does strike me in having watched you work over too many years that would be polite to mention for either of us, is that actually you do approach your work with whatever way you're accessing culture and the people in the community who you're working with, I don't know a word for it other than love, that you actually really love the culture and you really love the people, and that seems to have been a really great driver for you.
Yeah, it is love, isn't it? I mean, love and fulfilment, that we are the only people in the world that have the oldest culture. So that's something that you do carry as a great trophy in a way, I guess. But I think it's also the biggest and hardest challenge working in the creative industries. And you know, we are about storytelling, is getting the trust from community and getting that cultural knowledge where they trust you with their work that often has been plagiarized, or, you know, it's ended up in areas that was not culturally appropriate. So that takes a lot of communication. And I think that's what it is when you treat people with humanity and kindness. So I have a little thing next to my desk that says, "You're lucky you have a job, be kind." So in those moments when I get really frustrated, it helps. But I just know allowing that time, and I have been blessed. I mean, I've worked with some of the greatest law men and women in this country who have given me their material that's of age-old stories, you know, artwork that's been told for eons, and they're allowing me to put it into a new format, into new technology, and they're trusting that the story will still remain true to its origins. So for me, that's the greatest reward I get from the community, and that we have that visibility.
Is it possible for you to pick out a few career highlights in all that you've done so far?
I think one of the greatest highlights was Lydia Miller and myself and the late Vivian Walker and the late Justine Saunders. We're running a theatre company called the Aboriginal National Theatre Trust in the 80s. And, you know, we were young and skinny and gorgeous, and we were getting a lot of roles. But all the roles were very much the cardboard cutout of what was imagined as a First Nations woman. And so we sat down going, "I'm really tired." We wanted to show people that we could have an array of emotions when we were playing a character. So we decided to pool our money and look to commission a writer. And Lydia and I approached this from a very mercenary aspect, that the brief was, we want to play about three sisters who return to their mother's funeral and they haven't seen each other for 10 years. Pretty simple. And we don't want the word Aboriginal mentioned once, because we had this vision that if we wrote a play that was about three siblings and the challenges with their mother, that three Lebanese girls could play it, or three Pacific Islanders could play it, etc., because funerals and family are the universal stories as such. And so we looked at a writer that was the flavour of the month at that time. It happened to be Louie Nara. Anyway, we commissioned him to write this play called Radiance. And that, of course, went on to become a film as well, which was really exciting. And we've seen generation after generation perform that particular play. It was then we taught ourselves that to have the vibrant work and the work that was relevant, you actually had to develop it and integrate it into the mainstream because it just wasn't happening. And I see in that whole period of time now, filmmakers are now told, if you're going to write about an Aboriginal character, you need to have an Aboriginal consultant. You just can't write about an experience that you've never lived. And so we're seeing an adjustment with the lens. And so I think that's really exciting. And I think Radiance, in a way, was a bit of a catalyst to initiate those conversations of who could and couldn't write those stories and tell those stories. But again, it was a really collaborative approach, and I do believe collaboration is a way forward because both sides can give what each has in the greatness of skills.
Now, we've mentioned that you're stepping aside from your role as Head of Indigenous Programming at the Sydney Opera House, and you've just unveiled your final works with them. What can you tell us?
Well, we have a concert on April the 10th. It's a free event, part of our music series, which was going to be in November, but because of COVID, we couldn't continue the dance rights project. So this we've moved to April. And I wanted to make a very clear presence of young artists that are so amazing and the dialogues they're having in this country, which I think is all about tomorrow. So we called it Pebawori, and that means tomorrow in the local Sydney language. It really was a very thoughtful collaboration of myself and working with our music program. And I wanted to show the next face of Australian musicians. This is the face of tomorrow. So it's a lineup of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists along with artists of colour who all live in Australia. Most of them collaborate together anyway, but an extraordinary lineup. So, you know, Ziggy Ramo, I think, is one of the most incredible young performers we have, who's not afraid to speak the truth. And most of the songs and the lineup, they're all about truth telling. There's young women from Western Sydney who are Pacific Islanders who've had to move because of climate, water rising on their islands. So their stories are pretty amazing, that they are First Peoples from elsewhere but living in Australia. Artists like Sparrow, we have Milan Ring, we have JK47, Kobe D, Sea Breezy, Barker, all these young, amazing voices that a lot of people haven't heard. But what inspires me about them and what I'm thrilled about this concert lineup is they're using new technology, they're out there, but they are so steeped in their grandmother's stories and grandfathers, you know, and that says something to me, that culture has had this shift where they proudly wear it on their sleeve and very proud of their heritage. And they are the new voice and we need to listen to them because they're making some amazing commentary, not only on the challenges they've faced as young people and the judiciary, but also on their space in society, their invisibility. And so this will switch people's thinking of what Aboriginal music is as well, because it's so eclectic. I'm really excited.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
You know, it's amazing. It does not feel like 25 years, but I'm always reminded by the birthdays of my children because I was 9 months pregnant when we did the opening ceremony. And the 346 ladies from the Central Western Desert APY lands, 21 communities, every day they were singing an inmar saying, come out on the field and have the baby when we did the opening ceremony.
We wanted to talk about this role that you had there, Indigenous Cultural Advisor. It's a really large remit. What did it actually entail?
That was an earlier job. So I had about five positions at SOCOG. So I was working on the Cultural Olympiad with the festivals and then working on the torch relay, which was that position you just mentioned. And then Rick appointed me as the creative director for the Aboriginal segment. And so I started going out to communities in 96, 97, talking about the Olympics and what we would do for the opening event, because a lot of people were, should we be involved and we shouldn't. And so I went round to communities to gauge the interest. And then we did a few wonderful creatives. And then, you know, after going to communities and that, I said to Rick, you know, I can't just be the only creative on this because culturally it's not right, men and women's business. So then we appointed Stephen Page to come on. And, of course, he did all the choreography and lined all that side up, and I lined up all the communities and stuff. And so it was a great team.
Can I just go back to that moment when you were asked to do that part of the ceremony? What went through your mind when you were asked to put together such an enormous thing?
Well, initially I wasn't going to do it because the talk out in the community was, we're going to boycott. It's an opportunity to show the world about our, you know, human rights and the situations that were occurring at the time in the country, from deaths in custody and various other things. And then when I started talking to community, I'm going, okay, you could get an article in a newspaper or on radio. There wasn't social media like it is today. And I said, but, you know, you get 28 seconds on a news and it's forgotten, whereas this will leave a lasting legacy. And why don't we host the nation how we would have hosted back in the old ways? People would have travelled song lines, called out. So hence I started doing that creative for the awakening segment based on that. And, of course, I'd been working with Donnie Woolagoodja, the whole thing about the Wandjina and the song lines from the east to the west and so forth. So that determined all that. And so when I started talking to the artists, they all wanted to be involved. When I went to communities, they went, not sure. And then, of course, once I said, but if we don't do it, some old white dude's going to do it, and it's going to be really tokenistic, and you won't get the essence of who we are as the oldest living culture. And that was the key. When I said that, and I said, you know, if we bring old ways and get a song line and we do it, it will continue that legacy of, you know, our ancestral beliefs and nuances. And so they went, oh, okay. So, in fact, I'm very proud that it was the only Olympic event that didn't have a boycott. Because what I did then, when there were communities going, no, we're going to boycott, we're going to protest, I said, what do you want? And so I worked a lot with SOBO, the broadcasting network of SOCOG, and we managed to get buses on. So we took our international journalists every day to the late Isabella Coe. Sadly, she's passed, but when she brought the 10 Embassy up to Victoria Park in Glebe, so the stories were still being told to international journalists. And so, and then we put a space inside the Olympic event for all our organisations in Sydney to promote them and their art and so forth. So everyone had a voice.
I want to talk a little bit now about the legacy of that. And first of all, start with what it meant for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people around Australia. And you've already spoken about what it meant for people to be involved, the cultural exchange that was happening, the creative interactions, the capacity building in the cultural practice space. But I wonder what your reflections are on what it meant for the First Nations audience. And coming out of the 1990s, we've had Mabo reconciliation, but also, you know, the Howard government was in, there was a very different climate in terms of Aboriginal rights. And this was actually a really important cultural expression at that time. What are your reflections of that? And what did people say to you at the time?
There's so many moments, right? But I think the big thing was there was a nation that is a sporting nation, and they looked at Cathy Freeman as being the woman that might bring them gold, right? So there was that layer. They didn't really think about the ceremonies at the time, I think, the general Australian public, even the mainstream media, really. It was about the sport. So we had the time to cultivate, and we've had the time. I mean, you know, some of the old people were saying, oh, well, this was going to happen because
300 years ago, they were probably talking about it, you know, like how we know things happen for a reason. But I think it was we controlled it. So, you know, with fabulous Stephen Page and all the choreography and, you know, his positioning with the late David Page and the music, and, you know, it wasn't easy. And there were many times we were digging our heels in and fighting. So I remember one night at a production meeting, it was probably 1:30 in the morning, and David and I were there. And the boss came in and said, oh, you've got 11 minutes. We want to reduce that to 5 because everyone else has got 5. And so we think, and I said, no. And so David and I fought for the 11 minutes. And we sort of used, I said, whenever it gets tough, let's use a cultural opportunity. I said, culturally, we can't break this song up. So it has to be the 11 minutes. So, but that still didn't work. They were going, no, no, you have to cut back. And we just went, no, we're the oldest living culture. We need the 11 minutes. So anyway, we were able to hold that 11 minutes. So that was a real coup for us because it gave us the opportunity that whether it was the Torres Straits, whether it was Bawarina, whether it was Darwin, wherever people were from, Tasmania, they had a moment. You know, everyone had a minute to 2 minutes of doing their moment. And that was really, really important. But I can't go any further without mentioning Jacopora Manyarian. I mean, we don't realise what the Manyarian family have given to the South through cultural dance and nuances. But that of Jacopora holding that leading role of taking that young Nikki Webster on this thread across the whole Olympic opening event, not just the awakening segment, but the whole event. And I can remember going, do we start first? Because we are the first, right? And I sat with a whole, so what I did was all the old senior people, what we'd regard as the custodians or boss people, I would go back to them with everything. So they were guiding me. And so I said, I really think we should be the first because we're the first and digging that. And they said, what do they want to do? And I said, oh, they want to use the horses. And they said, it doesn't matter where we go, when we do it, if we do it with heart and our ancestors are with us, it will have a profound effect. So don't worry about being first because we know we are. And he said, let them bring out their horses because that's their culture and watch the earth churn. But he said, you watch, we'll come after that because when the winds lift the earth, they'll uplift that stadium and then we will come on. And it was just like, wow. So there are all these incredible moments. But I think the fact that we had creative control, authenticity and control of that. It was by us, it was for us, and we gave it to the world. And that was that humility of Jacopora Manyarian sharing what he did with all those, every single segment, and just walking tall, showed the generosity. And, you know, when you keep going back and you look at it, okay, it was phenomenal. The choreography was amazing. We had so many people, so many different language groups, so many different forms of dance, but we did it.
That's the late Auntie Rhoda Roberts, who passed away recently at the age of 66. We send our heartfelt condolences to her family and loved ones during this time. She leaves behind a lasting legacy and will be deeply missed. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt.
It's coming round again, slowly creeping in, of time and its command. Soon enough it comes and settles in its place, a shadow in my face, puts pressure in my day. This life, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days stand out nothing like I had planned. It's coming round again, slowly creeping ahead of time and its command. It shadows in its place, its shadow in my face puts pressure on my day. Soon enough it comes, here it is again, slowly creeping in, time and its command. Soon enough it comes, settles in its place, a shadow in my face, undignified and lame. This life, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days turned out nothing like I had planned. Control, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days turned out nothing like I had planned. This life, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days turned out nothing like I had planned. Control, well, it's slipping right through my hands. These days turned out nothing like I.
That's music from Thelma Plum and her song These Days.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Radio.
A new peak body will work to address family, domestic and sexual violence against Indigenous women and girls. Indigenous women are 27 times more likely to be hospitalised due to family violence, and advocates say the issue is often underreported and funding for programs is often misaligned. Our Ways Strong Together will work with community-controlled organisations to bring together lived experiences in an attempt to create better outcomes. Auntie Muriel Bamblett serves as the inaugural director. She comes to the role after a lifetime of work in areas of child protection and family welfare. Auntie Muriel is a fierce advocate for government accountability.
Yeah, look, obviously Our Ways Strong Together is the peak body that we've established that came out of a lot of consultations and a lot of work done. But, you know, like history sort of talks about the people that over the years have talked about family violence, the impact of family, domestic and sexual violence in the communities. And so, you know, you have in New South Wales, Marsha Aller, you know, who did so much work around sexual violence and brought that to the attention of government, which the lack of action. Bonnie Robinson, Helen Milroy, Tracy Milroy, Judy Atkinson, all those people that have spoken about violence and the impact and done training around trauma. We know that SNCC has, you know, been pushing this, but it really did come out of the establishment of the an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Advisory Committee that was charged with developing an action plan. And we went across, I was part of that advisory committee, and we travelled all over Australia listening to communities around the impact of violence and what we could put into the initial action plan that the government could fund. And so through a lot of those conversations with local communities, we were to hear some terrible stories about, you know, lack of, you know, coordination. Like governments had plans that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people had never seen. Nobody had a sense of who was funded for what and how, whether they were to be funded or should be funded. And so it was really quite, stark for us to be able to understand the lack of investment and really in programs and services for our people on the ground. And so from that, the government, you know, sort of took actions and really sort of appreciated what the depth of knowledge we gained. And at that time, Minister Rishworth said, I don't want to stop there, I want to develop our own plans. So we then went, and the minister committed for the first ever Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander First Nations plan on family, domestic and sexual violence. And so out of the first action plan, there was a commitment to establish the PEAK that we launched last week, Our Way Strong Together. And so I think it's just such a critical step in Australia.
There's no doubt about that, and a very exciting announcement. But and I want to dig a little bit deeper into what you're planning to achieve and how you're addressing it. But just before we do, of course, we've had conversations over the years about the different roles you've played as an advocate in the child protection space. So just on a personal level, what was it that attracted you to become the inaugural director of Our Ways Strong Together?
I guess because of the relationship really between all the jobs I've had and every career, and how family violence seemed to touch every element of everything that I've ever done. And so you see family violence in the justice system, you see family violence in housing and homelessness, you see it in the child protection system. You know, Andrew Jacquemos, when he did Task Force 1000 in the 20s, century, he, you know, identified that of the 1,000 children that were in care, 88% came into care because of family violence. And so all of these sort of family violence touches so many people. There are so many men that are in prison that have experienced family violence as children, as adolescents, experienced all levels of violence. So it touches so many elements of our life, but we just didn't come together to look at what do we need to do? How do we heal? How do we treat our people? What sort of programs do we need?
And so now that the body is set up, what are some of the ways or the strategies that you're using or looking to implement to achieve the outcomes you know are necessary in this space?
Look, I think our first priority obviously is to increase our membership. We need as many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from across our nation, particularly the jurisdictions, because we've got, and we hope, you know, the minister at the national level has already convened a MINCO meeting and a meeting of community service ministers, but also women's ministers from across the nation, to say that she wants all of the jurisdictions as well, buy-in, investment, and, you know, serious commitment. Because even though we've had closed the gap now for a number of years, and there's, you know, target 13 on, you know, obviously reducing the number of family and domestic and sexual violence incidents, we haven't been able to make traction on it. And so they're closed the gap. The coalition of PEAKs, they've, you know, been instrumental in setting up this PEAK as well. And so Janella Mills, the firm that she works for, King Wood and Mallison, there's lots of people, Snake, you know, did a lot of the national plan, setting up the governance structure of this. And so from our point of view, it really is about our membership first, but also getting the right people in the room that can change not just the policy and legislation, but the programming, the funding, the expenditure, get better data. I think one of our highest aspirations, obviously, is to give people the right information so they're informed. Many of our people said, we don't know what the data is. We don't know what the incidence of family violence is. Is it our Aboriginal men that's perpetrating the violence? Is it non-Aboriginal men? Is it perpetrated against, you know, what age group? Where's the violence most likely? Is it in the schools? Is it with young boys? Is it young girls? ourselves more accepting of violence. We just didn't have enough information to be able to, you know, I believe, to engage with the broader mainstream plan. There was lots of actions about Aboriginal, but nobody on the ground to actually implement them.
Yeah, that sort of leads very nicely into my next question. You know, obviously as a peak body, you're bringing together a lot of organisations, and I think one of the great potentials of this is that it will be a way to activate and empower community-controlled organisations and people working at the community coalface. I assume that's the approach that you're taking.
Yeah, look, it'll be led by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but already we've got a number of peaks that we work, but we've worked in silo, and a lot of funding or services that have set up have been mostly at the tertiary end, and so critical to it, but it's, you know, we've got to get programs in there that work much earlier. So, at the, you know, you've got to recognise the family violence prevention legal services and their role in, you know, constantly putting family violence and the numbers in the space. But we've got to also, you know, engage with housing services. We've got to be able to, you know, improve access to courts, to justice systems, but also education. A lot of our children are experiencing violence in the school, whether it's through bullying, but they're dealing with violence in the school, violence at home, and then often child protection systems perpetrate another level of violence against children when we remove them. And so I think from, you know, obviously my point of view, heading up SNAKE, the National Voice for Children, and being, you know, the CEO of an Aboriginal organisation, I see the implications of, you know, the impact on violence on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children every day. And I think, you know, the work of SNAKE in, through Young Black Eyes and training and getting our community to understand the impact of violence on children, learned violence, but also trauma and treatment. It goes to the fact that we need a whole of system response. I think this organisation will change the way that we advocate for services. We have certainly have a number of rights as far as the number of services that we provide, but the very basics are not provided in many of our communities. Obviously, within this peak is health as well, and so the role of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, we've got NACHO at the table, and they're often first responders. So they see our people in local communities, they see our people in hospitals, they present to clinics. So family violence and our responses shouldn't, we should be able to link our families into support wherever they come in. There shouldn't be a wrong door to get a response or treatment or support for family violence.
It's really clear in listening to you describe that, Aunty Muriel, that one of the really important things about this initiative and the way this peak body will work is that it does break through those silos. And I guess people who aren't familiar with this area perhaps don't realise how hard it is to match up basic things like health and housing for people who are trying to escape domestic violence. So what are you hoping will be the end result of this? I mean, I guess I'm asking, what would success look like in this area for you?
Look, I think you touched on the intersectionality of this. I mean, we're dealing with brother boys, sister girls. We're dealing with, you know, becoming up for programs for men, for, you know, perpetrators, but also victims. We've got programs for, you know, looking at responses for women, for children. Elder abuse is a really big issue in our community. And so the intersectionality, but I think it's about how do we, you know, get a whole of government response. There's a danger that, you know, you've got Minister Plibersek. She's only got one portfolio area. So it's how do we get justice involved, sitting at the table, ministers and from across the jurisdictions and buy-in, health, housing, as you said, education, child protection. The relationship with drug and alcohol is also, you know, we need to be able to bring them into the table. But I think it's about data, it's about giving evidence, about giving our people the right tools to become the best advocates. And I think the PEAK will be the lead in driving a high-level advocacy to get better investment, to get better planning. So at the moment, we're charged with developing the next action plan that will come out of our First Nations plan. And so we're also looking at how do we bring together a governance group from each jurisdiction, but also have the government sitting at the table so that they can report and account against. We're also looking at establishing a family violence policy partnership, how to close the gap. So this work is starting to culminate. This is, I think, a game changer. I think having a PEAK, having a voice, having a voice made up of sector leaders of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that can come up with solutions, and having a government at the moment that's prepared to listen and be able to put things on the ground to make things better for our people.
I was actually reflecting on that, listening to you speak about the many ways in which you're bringing people together around the table and making this part of the national agenda. The issue, as you said earlier, has been one that has plagued our community. It's been systemic. It's often been used as an excuse to roll out policies like the Northern Territory intervention. It really does feel like this is a game changer. That must feel like a very exciting moment for somebody like you who's been at the coalface and has been advocating for this kind of change on behalf of children, on behalf of families for a really long time.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes to the way, I guess, that governments have always, you know, sort of governed us, and, you know, they put us into silos and then get us to squabble about a small bucket of money. And so I believe this time, you know, by us having collective, you know, leadership in the room, by, you know, breaking down those silos, that we can, you know, still be able to get investment in the areas. It was just so amazing for me when I went to the NACHO conference and I heard the men read out a statement and saying, we do want to stand up against violence. We do want action. And so, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was at the KWI with Craig Rigby from South Australia, and he was leading as far as therapeutic responses and how do we, what programs do we, and the room was full, 340 people in the room that we're focused on treatment. We want, you know, men's behaviour change. We want to see change. And so to be able to bring all those people into the room to be able to bring about change, I think, as I said, it's a game changer, I think. When we developed the first action plan, we didn't know who to hand it to. There was no one person we could hand it to.
Well, I do hope as you do the next phase of this important work, you'll come back and keep us informed so that people can see how this is unfolding. You did mention that you're looking for more membership. If people are listening, how can they find out more about what you're doing?
Well, they can contact, obviously, our organisation, the PEAK organisation. We've set up a website. So if you look up Our Ways Strong Together, Olga Havenant has been appointed as our first CEO, and she's a real gun. She's just amazing. She obviously has lived her whole life Aboriginal, you know, in the Northern Territory, and so she's led so many, you know, she's been an activist for change, and she's really sort of in there getting things happening. And so you can look on our website. So I would look go to there and sign up for membership. We're having a whole media campaign very shortly so that people will get sick of us. But, you know, we're being led by Danella Mills, who's, you know, chair of NACHO, but also the chair of the board of Our Ways Strong Together. So you will see a lot more of us.
Well, I can only say that's a good thing, because you know how much I admire you. And as you say, Olga Havenant is quite a powerhouse as well. So we couldn't be in better hands for this really important work. Just one thing before we finish our conversation. You've obviously worked in really tricky areas. I've always admired your commitment in the very difficult spaces of child protection. You're coming into another very tricky space here. So I just wondered if you could share with us how you keep yourself optimistic and hopeful.
I think I always look at the potential to where what we can do, change and do different, look at innovation, different things. And so, VACA has kept me young, I believe. VACA's kept my brain sort of, agile. And so I think being able to always see the potential or see difference or be able to drive change. And so some of the things that I'm working on, obviously treaty in Victoria and, that's been an amazing journey. I think I remember some of the early conversations with you about treaty. I was very naive back then. And so now, being much more, informed about treaty, I just think it's got so much potential, but so much hard work that we as Aboriginal people need to do to make treaty work. And so, but it's so amazing. And I just think I'm a glass always half full or three quarters full. So I think I always look for, new and brighter things. And so I want to work on an Aboriginal school for kids in child protection because there's too many of our kids school refusing, dropping out and not where schools aren't good places for kids that have been through huge amounts of trauma. And so, that's one of my things that I'm working on, but there's lots of things I'm working on, obviously, all the time.
Well, I love your vision and I love your enthusiasm and I love your energy, and it rubs off so positively on the rest of us. And I think that's why you've always been one of my favourite aunties, but I'll call you a young auntie now since you're saying you're feeling young. One of my favourite young aunties. And I know how busy you are, so I really appreciate you taking some time with us on Speaking Out to talk about this really important game-changing initiative.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Auntie Muriel Bamblett speaking with me about Our Ways Strong Together. I've always admired her unending commitment to making things better.
This is Speaking Out, a National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Affairs show produced and presented by Indigenous broadcasters on ABC Radio.
Last year in the northern New South Wales town of Inverell, Indigenous families were enjoying a day out at their local pool when staff called the police over some kids misbehaving. Thomas Davis was dropping off money to his kids when he saw police were getting ready to escort the families out of the pool for alleged trespassing. Since the incident in March last year, his children have been scared to go back. Incidents like this involving First Nations young people and children have also been on the rise across the country, with more than a quarter of the incidents reported to the Racism Call It Out Register involving young people under the age of 18. Producer Janaea Gibbs-Muir takes a closer look at the incident and its aftermath.
It did. Just more sad just to see that the country's gone backwards and it's not going forwards like it should be. Nothing's changed at all. I think it's gotten worse.
Local father Thomas Davis, along with other First Nations families from Inverell, are lodging a complaint with the Human Rights Commission after an alleged incident that happened last year at their local pool.
My kids went down to the pool with his friend and his parents, went down there on the weekend just for a bit of a swim. We just went down there just to drop some money off just so we could purchase a couple of things at the canteen for lunch and whatnot. And then on the way down there, we just noticed that there was a bull wagon at the front of the pool, which straight away we sort of thought, oh, that's a bit odd, you know. It's a bit of a drastic measure to have police at the pool. And then, upon walking in, we've seen that they had all the Aboriginal kids that were in the back heated pool area, they were all out and they were talking to an elder and a couple of other people. And that's when my partner's just gone over just to see what was going on, because we just automatically felt sick in the gut and just knew that something wasn't right.
While at the pool, multiple families were asked to leave by police. Thomas's partner had tried to talk to staff about why they and other Indigenous families were being targeted and asked to leave.
Partners asked what has happened and they've just said the kids were just misbehaving, showing antisocial behaviour, doing bombs and things like that, and then everyone's been asked to leave and told that we could come back tomorrow, more or less. But that, didn't really sit right with me, it didn't.
Since the incident last year, Thomas says that his kids no longer feel safe at the pool and it has left them feeling excluded from their local school's sport activities.
A few of the kids, they didn't go to school for a couple of weeks after, and it's been a bit of a pain lately too because school sport is at the pool. So every week we don't send the kids to school, or we send them to school but just tell them no, we don't want the kids participating in school sport.
Young people being racially attacked has become more common since the referendum in 2023. The Call It Out Register annual report found that First Nations children and young people aged 0 to 19 account for 29% of their reports from 2024 to 2025. Professor Bec Giles, who has researched Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people's experiences with racism, says that when a young Indigenous person is involved in a racist incident, it can have a negative effect on their mental health and self-worth.
We have done a study with Aboriginal young people where they've talked to us about how racism makes them feel. So we know from our study, it's called Aboriginal Adolescents' Experiences of Racism, or AIRS, that they've said that when they experience racism, it makes them feel sad, it makes them feel hurt, makes them feel angry, makes them feel frustrated. So a lot of negative things. Some positive outcomes too, because recognizing that something's happening that probably shouldn't be, and standing up for racism can give some agency. But we do know that these issues can cause mental health issues as well. So over time, rumination, anxiety, depression. So it can be quite problematic.
Bec also said that public spaces are where Aboriginal young people are most likely to encounter instances of racism, which has led to more children and young people starting to self-exclude from these spaces.
So Aboriginal young people told us they frequently get excluded from public places, for example, shops or shopping centres, places like that. Sometimes they're told they look like someone who's caused trouble before, or sometimes they're not given an explanation at all and just told they need to leave. But they also notice these things happen to them and not their friends who are not Aboriginal.
In regional towns, it's more common for young people to notice or feel the effects of racism early on. Thomas says in his personal experience growing up in a small community, the racist attitudes are common and situations like this are inevitable.
And because I went through it as a young fellow as well, you sort of think, oh, by the time I have kids, hopefully they won't have to go through it. But like I said on a post I put up early, 80% of the country would disagree with me, but I've been around and seen it all for myself, and it's still alive and quite well, that's for sure. Well, look at the freedom rides they had in Moree years ago. That didn't do anything if they're still kicking us out of the pool down here. And I've heard of a few other instances in Tamworth and Sydney and other places like that as well.
He hopes that by taking this to the Human Rights Commission, that it will help his kids be strong and be able to call out racism when they experience it.
That's not right. And for me to visually see it myself just on the scale that it was, and for my video to blow up the way it was, obviously everyone else saw that it was quite outrageous, you know what I mean? It wasn't right. I've sat back, I've been through it, I've sat there and watched my mum and grandmother and things fight and tell me little things like if you're at school or if you go to the shops and people are following you around, just to don't let it get the best of you, you know, always fight for you know what's right and things like that. So that's just why I'm doing what I'm doing now. So God forbid the kids, they go through it when they get older, but at least if it happens in their lifetime, they know that they can stand up and speak out.
That package was prepared by our producer, Janaya Gibbs-Muir. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on social media via ABC Indigenous or on ABC Listen, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by Rudy Bremer. This week, Rudy is exploring the role unions have played in the advancement of Aboriginal civil rights, from the wharves of Woolloomooloo to the cattle stations of Wave Hill to the cotton fields of Wee Waa. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.